This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. We'll get an update on the nonprofit Literacy for Life in San Luis Obispo.
It's been proven, there's been research done, that to stop the cycle of non-literacy, the most important thing is to have books in the home.
Also, ballots go out in the mail today to voters in California, and there are many ways to vote in this upcoming recall election.
Every county elections office is also a voting place. So wherever you live in California, if you want to vote in person after August 16th, you can do that at your county elections office during normal business hours.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, August 16th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Beyond the Furrows is KCBX's 12-part series on farm workers on the Central Coast. On this week's episode, Francisco Martinez reports on the efforts to vaccinate farm workers as the Delta variant spreads.
Dr. Vondo Reynoso says she knows vaccinating everyone possible is important to ending the pandemic. But as Santa Barbara County's public health director, she knows not everyone in the county has equal access to the vaccines, and some are disproportionately affected by the coronavirus. This includes the county's Latinx population, which she says faces a disproportionate burden of disease.
So when we drilled down to what that meant, we found that farm workers were also bearing the burden of being cases and hospitalization as well.
The disproportionate health inequities farm workers face led to the county public health department launching what Dr. Do Reynoso calls health equity clinics. They're for farm workers and their families. She says as of August 3rd, mobile health clinics provided farm workers almost 3,600 single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccines across 40 different agricultural work sites. But Dr. Do Reynoso says she knows issues will arise, whether they are systemic or logistical. The systemic obstacles we've explored in the series, such as language barriers or socioeconomic status, add a nuanced challenge to this community's vaccination efforts because those barriers contribute to mistrust.
You can't really erase the deep-seated mistrust towards government that exists for many communities. Some may still will never feel comfortable going to a clinic or accessing a governmental service like vaccination because of immigration fears.
Many of the people I've spoken with say farm workers have these fears because they're worried their immigration status will be used against them. Dr. Do Reynoso says even though the state has COVID-19 sick pay benefits, farm workers are hesitant to get vaccinated because they might miss work due to side effects from the shot.
And for many families, a couple of days of lost work can be devastating when you live paycheck to paycheck.
Logistically, Dr. Do Reynoso says she knows many partners need to come together to get vaccines out. That means collaborating with community organizers, partnering with farm companies themselves, or mobilizing vaccinations to get more shots in people's arms. It means getting farm companies like Freshway Farms involved. Heidi Garcia, the human resources manager at Freshway Farms in Santa Maria, says keeping up with new information about the coronavirus is the biggest challenge. She says that Freshway's efforts are about more than just getting shots into arms.
Doing and wanting to do what's right isn't where it ends. We also have to do a good job at educating and informing them and keeping them up to date.
Garcia says that there have not been COVID-19 surges among Freshway's workers because the company has been proactive in getting its employees vaccinated. She says many Freshway workers chose to get their shots when the company first offered clinics.
Those that didn't, that were just unsure if they wanted to or not, were then requesting the second round that they wanted to be vaccinated, and we went ahead and we moved forward with that.
To learn more, I spoke to Eduardo, a strawberry farm worker in the Santa Maria area. He's fully vaccinated with two doses. Eduardo is 28, from Oaxaca, Mexico, and had only been in the U.S. for 3 months when we talked in July. He did not want to identify where he worked. Eduardo says his boss was urging farm workers to get their shots, even bringing in Líderes Campesinas, a farm worker advocacy organization, to urge hesitant workers to receive their vaccines. He says that he sees his boss care about them and that she cares that everyone gets vaccinated so they don't get sick. Even so, Eduardo says he's still seen some of his coworkers refuse to get vaccinated. He says he's heard of farm workers who weren't vaccinated because they're scared of what can happen. But Eduardo says he's told them nothing has happened to him since he got his jabs 3 months ago. He says he's still here. Nothing happened. Farm workers who haven't been vaccinated have a variety of reasons for their hesitance. Some are worried, as Eduardo tells me, about its potential side effects, but others just don't want it. I spoke to a farm worker who wished to remain anonymous at a Santa Maria strip mall. The 36-year-old says he just doesn't want the vaccine at the moment and didn't give any other reason than that. I asked him what would make him want the vaccine, and he told me he'd get it if the company he works for suggested vaccination. So I asked him, are they not suggesting it already? He gave me a mixed response.
Sí, sí lo sugiere.
The farm worker first suggests that his company does suggest it, but then backtracks and says they don't suggest it. He adds that they do help employees who want to get vaccinated, but says vaccination isn't necessary. He calls it a personal decision. Andrea Cabrera, an organizer with Líderes Campesinas and a former farm worker, says she knows getting farm workers vaccinated is important. According to her, many farm workers fall for misinformation from social media like Facebook and WhatsApp. Cabrera is working to challenge vaccine hesitancy. Like Eduardo, she uses her own experience to sway unvaccinated farm workers into getting a shot and emphasizes one of the vaccine's overall benefits, preventing death. Cabrera says she asked farm workers how many people have died from COVID without the vaccine versus those who are fully vaccinated. That question, she says, leads the farm workers to have another thought. The vaccine isn't doing anything other than benefiting them. Cabrera's approach is about looking to the future with hope. It appeals to the farm workers' desire to do better for themselves and their families. It's why she tells them that getting a vaccine is about taking care of themselves, their families, and their children. She says when they do that, they'll be more likely to lift themselves up. Cabrera's efforts and those of the Santa Barbara County Public Health Department, the participating farm companies, and community organizers are all aimed at addressing COVID's disproportionate impact on farm workers. Next week, we'll explore another public health issue that disproportionately affects farm workers, pesticides. For KCBX News, I'm Francisco Martinez.
Beyond the Furrows is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. Literacy for Life in San Luis Obispo is a nonprofit organization that partners with libraries throughout the county to teach adult learners English language skills. Contributor Beth Thornton spoke with the executive director, Bernadette Bernardi.
Literacy for Life has been around in San Luis Obispo for many years. Give us some background information about the organization.
Yes, Literacy for Life started as a volunteer-only organization back in the mid-70s to address essentially the influx of Vietnamese immigrants to our area. So a group of volunteers that were all educators noticed the need and started addressing it. Then shortly thereafter, right after the new library building was built, the library had a part-time literacy program coordinator. Both entities realized that they were duplicating services, so the powers that be got together and came up with the relationship that exists now, and we're still that same partnership, and that partnership enables us to be the literacy program for all of the libraries in San Luis Obispo County, so not just San Luis Obispo, including those that aren't necessarily under the umbrella of the San Luis Obispo County library system, for instance, Paso Robles and a few others. And all of those relationships allow us, now Literacy for Life, to be the California State Library Literacy Service for our county.
What does that mean? Does that mean that you get funds from the state, or do you have training from the state?
A lot of both. It turns out that the California State Library Literacy Services is our main funder, or has been historically. That service, the California State Library Literacy Service, also provides staff development and great opportunity for networking with other programs throughout the state that have either a literacy program coordinator as a library staff person or that are set up as we are as a partnership between the nonprofit and the library.
Give us an idea of the literacy rates in San Luis Obispo County.
Historically, and it probably hasn't changed much, and it might have increased in percentage, right around 17% of adults, and we're talking adults because that's who we serve, 16 and older, and the 16-year-olds cannot be in school. So about 70% of that population, and That means, of course, if you're an adult and you live in this world, regardless of your first language knowledge, you're not going to be totally not literate because you live in the world, you maybe drive a car, all of that. So we're not talking about total non-literacy, but we are talking about hugely challenged, especially more and more as our world, you know, progresses into and has COVID year has shown, you know, people need to be online and be fluent in other things besides just reading and writing words.
How do you connect with people? How do adults wanting to improve their literacy skills find you?
We're countywide. So we have at least one learning center in most communities in our county. Some of them have two. Mostly it's been word of mouth for learners. Lately, you know, I can only go with what happens since COVID, you know, things have changed drastically because people are preoccupied with, let's say you yourself as a parent are trying to improve your literacy skills, but you have three children at home that are, you know, on Zoom and all of that. So given all that, but basically historically, we have not had to recruit for learners. And people get referred from their work many times, especially the folks who are speakers of English as a first language. And by the way, not being literate has nothing to do with intelligence. It just has to do with exposure and having been taught or not taught. And so especially if you grew up in the English-speaking world but don't read or write well, it's very difficult for those people to come to us and ask for help. As you can imagine, there's a lot of shame involved. But as I was saying, we get some of those referrals from employers who want to promote these people and don't understand why they say no to promotions, but they figure it out. And the reason why is because then they have to learn all over again what they've memorized.
And is that what drives most people to join the program, advancement at work or perhaps helping their children with their homework, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Both of those things, especially those that we help that are English as a second language learners, you know, they're here because they're seeking a better life. They're seeking more education and all of that. And it's been proven, there's been research done that to stop the cycle of non-literacy, the most important thing is to have books in the home. And you don't typically have books in the home if you're not a reader or a writer extensively. And that's how we really help children. And yes, the parents, if you're a parent yourself or a grandparent or have neighbors that have children, you know that one of the most important things for a caregiver of a young child in school is to be able to communicate and understand what's going on in that child's schooling.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Bernadette Bernardi from Literacy for Life in San Luis Obispo. Tell me a little bit about becoming a tutor and how that part of it works.
We recruit. We've used all the different medias, including your station. Media have always been very generous with in-kind donations to our program as to other nonprofits in the area. So we recruit, advertise. The requirements to be a tutor is you don't have to have had teaching experience, though fortunately we do have just a natural inclination, I guess, that people who want to volunteer with us, lots of them have been either retired or existing instructors or teachers. We do require that everyone, regardless of prior experience and education, take our tutor training. Because it is different than working in a classroom, very different. Because our center of our program is that there's a little saying, each one teach one. So we have one tutor to one learner. So the tutors that we recruit go through our training, and then Usually we match them with each of our centers has a volunteer center director, if you can imagine that. I'm always awestruck by that. Essentially, there are managers out in the field, but they're also volunteers. So they take in the new tutors and match them with the new learners.
When you are doing in-person tutoring, you must be scheduling around a work day or childcare needs of the adult learners.
As much as possible, but as you might imagine, that can become overwhelming. We do have very set hours at our in-person learning centers, and some of them are a little bit more fluid than others. For instance, rather than just have like a 2-hour window, some have a 4-hour window that people can come and go. That's one thing, you know, something positive, as I think we all realize, has come out of this pandemic. And, you know, virtual tutoring and learning, then it just all has to do with between the tutor and the learner, whatever they set up. We do realize the challenges for most of our learners to even walk in our door.
And this is a free service.
It's absolutely free.
Talk about how this program changes people's lives.
Whether it's to be able to read instructions on a prescription, whether it's to be able to speak to your child's teacher and understand the paperwork that gets sent home. And then, of course, there are the skills that make other types of work more accessible. Changes lives and maybe in little mini steps, but it also changes lives in being able to pass the citizenship test, which is very comprehensive. And so that certainly changes families' lives, individuals' lives. It allows for people who didn't complete high school here to then be able to complete the GED requirements and actually attain a high school diploma. We also have served the literacy programs at the California Men's Colony, which are basically set up the same way as our outside programs are. Literate inmates we've trained to be tutors, and then they worked with non-literate inmates. And it's such a plus-plus. The individuals, the men who volunteer to be tutors, they get a lot of satisfaction out of it, as well as, you know, for lack of a better word, brownie points on their record. And they're helping, you know, a fellow inmate, which is, there's nothing better.
So how can people get in touch with you as a learner or as a tutor?
The best way would be email for tutors. We're in the midst of recruiting for tutors. Learners, many times they're more comfortable calling. And even though someone doesn't pick up, I want to stress that, you know, we can check our messages and callbacks.
And your website is literacyforlifeslo.org, and the phone numbers and emails are on the website. Is there anything else you want to add?
I like to share our mission statement because I think it says so much of who we are and what we do. Literacy for Life transforms the community, empowering individuals by removing barriers to success and strengthening relationships through the power of literacy.
Thank you, Bernadette Bernardi from Literacy for Life in San Luis Obispo. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
Starting today, ballots are being sent out to all registered voters in California for the recall election of Governor Gavin Newsom. KCSB's Ashley Rush spoke with Santa Barbara County Clerk Recorder Joseph Holland.
The election will be California's first gubernatorial recall in nearly two decades. How did we get here? Backlash towards Newsom has arisen primarily from Republican activists who say they are frustrated with Newsom's handling of the pandemic and business restrictions, high taxes and cost of living, and homelessness in California. Recall organizers were required to turn in 1.5 million signatures from registered California voters by March 17th. Ultimately, 2.1 million signatures were turned in, but 400,000 were eventually deemed invalid and thrown out. Now, with the election date set for September 14th, voters can be expected to be asked the following two questions on their ballot. Number one, should the elected official be removed from office? And number two, if the official is removed, who should take their place? Newsom will be recalled if more than 50% of voters answer yes to the first question, and the candidate who wins the most votes will replace him. 46 replacement candidates are running against him, with Republicans dominating the field. Conservative talk radio host Larry Elder and reality TV star Caitlyn Jenner are among high-profile contenders. Establishment Democrats are notably absent from the list, with the party overwhelmingly backing the anti-recall campaign. A coalition of Democratic figures, including President Joe Biden, Senators Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, and Stacey Abrams, have also vocalized their support for Newsom. To learn more about what voters should know about the recall election here in Santa Barbara, I spoke with SB County Registrar of Voters Joseph Holland. You're currently preparing for the September 14th vote that will decide the fate of Governor Gavin Newsom. What logistical challenges does this year's recall election bring to your office?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the first election that I ever conducted in my position was the recall of Gray Davis in 2003. In that election, it was the same format as this. The first question is, do you want to recall the governor? Yes or no? If the majority of votes, so 50% plus one across the state, vote yes, then the voter has a choice. Well, then we move on to the next part, which in 2003, there were 135 candidates, one of which was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who got the plurality of the votes in 2003 and became the governor. For this election, it's the same format. The very first question is yes or no. Do you want to recall the governor? And then there are, for this time, only 46 candidates if you want to vote for that. But it is a challenge because a lot of these 46 candidates are unknown and to most of the voters, and so you need to do a little research.
From a logistical standpoint, what should voters know about the voting process? So can they cast their ballots by mail, and when can they expect to receive their ballot?
So for this election, like in the November 2020 election, we mailed every voter a ballot. And in November 2020, that was to make it safer for voters to vote. Probably 50,000 of the registered voters in Santa Barbara County had never voted by mail before. So that was new to them. So what voters need to remember is that fill out your ballot. When you put it in the return envelope, just make sure that you sign that envelope. So it's a very easy process. The return envelope does not need to have a stamp on it. So you can put it in any blue mailbox or however you want to get it to your post office. Or we have 25 to 30 county elections drop boxes located across the county. So if you want to deliver it directly to your elections official, then just drop it in one of those drop boxes. So we're giving you plenty of options here. You can vote on election day, drop it off at a polling place on election day at any one of our 54 polling places that are going to be open from 7 in the morning till 8 in the evening on September 14th, election day. But there's really no reason to wait. Once you get your ballot, just make your choices ahead of time before September 14th. Get your ballot in there and get it counted.
And do you envision that turnout for this election will be high?
That's a really good question. And so the only data we had to go on was the 2003 recall election. And elections back then were completely different. Back then, we didn't mail a ballot to every voter. Only 30% of the people in 2003 voted by mail. So the turnout then was 66%, which was high. We did not expect for a special election for that turnout to be that high. So for this election, I think we're more or less thinking that we're going to get at least that amount of turnout because we're mailing everybody a ballot. But we're probably going to get around a 70% turnout is what I think we're planning for.
And can you give us a timeline of important dates? When should people register to vote?
The deadline to register to vote is August 30th. So if you're not registered, you want to register to vote by August 30th, and we'll get you a ballot out. And of course, it's very easy to register, sbcvote.com, and you can register online. The next important date is, of course, Election Day, September 14th, where we're going to have 54 polling places open. The thing to remember is that even if you miss the deadline of August 30th to register to vote, you can still come into any one of our three offices and register, and then you just have to vote provisionally. And on Election Day, you can even go to any one of our 54 polling places and register to vote. And we'll just, again, issue a provisional ballot just to make sure that you haven't already voted somewhere else in the state. But, you know, we make it real easy. There's no excuse, really, to not vote.
Are you still looking for volunteers to work the polls? And how can people get involved with this opportunity?
Yes, we are still looking for poll workers. So if you go to our website, sbcvote.com, I just took a look at it. It's super easy to fill out an application to become an election officer, poll worker. Pays $180 to $240 a day. You will need to be available on September 14th from like 6 in the morning until everything's wrapped up after 8 o'clock when the polls close. It's pretty exciting to do, and I know for UCSB, I don't think classes even start by September 14th. So if students are back in town, I would encourage them to be a poll worker, and you'll learn a lot about democracy. So I really encourage folks to do that.
And where can listeners go for more information about the recall and voting process in general?
I just encourage everybody to go to sbcvote.com. That's our website, and you can look up everything. You can get your sample ballot there. You can see the ballot. It's super easy to get as much information on this election as you could possibly need.
Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
The County of Santa Barbara is spending $2.8 million on this election. So don't let us waste your money. Cast your ballot, get it in. We check every signature. We do not count a ballot unless the envelope's been signed and verified. And then election results will go up at 8 o'clock on election night, September 14th. And I think most people will know across the state what the outcome is a few minutes after 8 on election night.
Thank you to SB County Registrar of Voters, Joseph Holland, for speaking with me about the upcoming recall election of Governor Gavin Newsom on September 14th. I'm Ashley Rush.
Ashley Rush is a student reporter at KCSB in Santa Barbara. You'll find voter information at the San Luis Obispo County and Monterey County websites as well. And there are some misconceptions surrounding this recall vote. Cap Radio's Randall White spoke with PolitiFact California's fact checker, Chris Nichols, to help clear things up.
Chris, voters will soon have the chance to decide whether Governor Gavin Newsom should remain in office or be removed. But there are false claims swirling around online about the recall process. Tell us about some of those.
Hey, Randall, it's good to speak with you. And that's right. Election officials here in Sacramento County recently sent out a notice about one very false rumor that's going around. It claimed that voters won't be able to cast their ballot in person due to the county's new health order, which requires people to wear masks at indoor public settings, regardless of their vaccination status. Now, several other counties, such as Los Angeles, have the same mandate. But no matter where you live in California, that rumor about not being able to vote in person is completely false. The mask rules don't prevent anyone from voting in person.
And Chris, Californians will have many options for how to return their ballots. What are some of those?
They will. Before Election Day on September 14th, registered voters can, of course, take the ballot that they are going to receive in the mail, fill it out, and send it back through the mail. You can also use a secure drop box. I spoke with Kim Alexander of the California Voter Foundation about some of the options.
Every county will have in-person voting available on Election Day, September 14th. In addition to that, every county elections office is also a voting place. So wherever you live in California, if you want to vote in person after August 16th, you can do that at your county elections office during normal business hours.
She mentioned August 16th. That's Monday, and that's the deadline for when local election officials must start sending out vote-by-mail ballots to all registered voters here in California.
There's also been some misinformation about the vote-by-mail ballots. What is being said, and then what are the facts?
Well, some popular posts on social media claim that Newsom is using the new and fast-spreading Delta variant as an excuse to send mail-in ballots to all voters ahead of the recall. But this claim is false. The decision to use mail-in ballots was made this winter, long before anyone knew about the Delta variant. It was made with health concerns in mind, but it was not a recent decision.
Finally, Chris, many Californians have never voted in a recall election. There's some confusion about whether they have to answer each of the two questions that they see on the ballot. Can you clear that up?
Sure. There's a lot of freedom in how voters can choose to answer these two questions or even not answer them. For example, a voter could answer no to the first question and still make a selection for a replacement candidate. Both of your votes will count under that scenario.
And what if you answer the first question but decide not to select a replacement candidate?
Your vote on that first question would still be counted. Voters are free to answer one or both questions as they see fit.
Great to know as always. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Randall.
That was Cap Radio's Randall White speaking with PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols. And now it's time for Working Lunch.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chambers weekly series. I'm Jim D'Antona, president and CEO of the San Luis Chamber. And today you'll get to be a part of my conversation with Tolosa Winery's president and CEO, June McIver. She joined the Tolosa team after a successful law career, committed to raising the profile of the San Luis Obispo Coast wine country in general and the Edna Valley AVA in particular. June recently concluded a three-year term as president of the San Luis Obispo Coast Wine Collective. June, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
President and CEO of a winery sounds like an amazing title, but what does it look like on a day-to-day basis? Are you down in the cellar, out in the vineyard, meeting people in the tasting room?
Sure. I make the wine. No. Are you kidding? They don't let me anywhere near the cellar. They want me out of the vineyards. They do let me talk to guests once in a while, but really it's running the business, really setting our strategic vision, supporting the team, making sure that the teams have what they need to do their job to the best they can. The Edna Valley is the perfect climate for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So that's what we wanted to be excellent at and keep our focus on that.
Recently, you hosted Sustainability Day.
Tolosa has always had a commitment to sustainability. You know, we put in a solar array in 2009. So solar has been a big part of it. When we renovated our outdoor spaces in 2016, we installed electric car charging stations. You know, we've got a Tesla dual station and a regular one. But really, to me, if you're not panicked about what's happening to our planet right now, you're not paying attention. Actually, I do get panicked when I talk about it. But I also felt, you know, I was thinking about this last year, and I just didn't feel like I didn't know what I could do. You know, it just seems like such a big problem, and it's complicated, and there's just so many pieces to it. And we're, you know, I'm one person at a very small company. You know, what can we really do? And then you love it. I know. I discovered this book. It's What If Solving the Climate Crisis is Simple. Right? Like, this is what I needed. I needed someone to tell me, oh, it's simple. And the premise of the book really is that, fossil fuels are the main problem for climate change. And if we could just eliminate our use of fossil fuels, we will make incredible strides to getting where we need to on climate change. Yes, there's other issues and all that, but solve this first, the end of use of fossil fuels, and then we can move on to the others. We took the mantra of the book, which we pledged to eliminate our use of fossil fuels by the year 2040 and absolutely positively not fail. So that is super important to us. But we're to implement that, we've gone through a lot of changes. So we joined the Porto Protocol, which is a wine industry focused group that focuses on sustainability in the wine industry. And it's really all about sharing ideas. So we've been getting a lot of ideas for that. We also set up internally working groups to focus on these issues. So our vineyards are SIP certified, sustainability in practice. And that's the program of the Central Coast Vineyard Team. And they have three pillars to their sustainability program. It's people, planet, and prosperity. Because if you don't take care of your people, it's not going to work. And if you can't continue your business model, prosperity, people aren't going to do it either. And then also, of course, saving the planet. So we have a working group around each one of those pillars. And it's employees volunteer to be on a working group. They got to pick which one was of interest to them. And those groups have subcommittees, and they've really been doing a lot of brainstorming about what can we do. And some amazing ideas have come out of that and coming out of the Porter Protocol, and also just talking to our neighbors and making this a priority. So some of the ideas that have come out, our first meeting with the Porter Protocol, another winery was talking about what they were doing with pulse cooling. So, you know, we've got these big tanks, you ferment grapes, it creates a lot of heat, you need to cool them down. So they have jackets around them that we pump glycol around. And it's continuously pumping glycol, and it goes around all of the tanks. Well, that spends a lot of energy. So what the idea is that you only did it periodically. You pump enough glycol, let the glycol warm up, the wine cool down. And then when it gets to a certain ratio there, then you run the pump again. So you're not continually pumping. So it's a big energy savings. So we're doing trials on that for our winery. We're going to plant a Miyawaki forest, which is something we learned from our neighbor Chamasol. And theirs is already planted. Look it up. Miyawaki Forest is pretty cool. We're talking about adding additional solar panels. We partnered with Voltus to measure the energy that we're using right now, because we don't even know where we were as a benchmark. And we shut down almost everything that we can every Wednesday a month, just to see how far can we get it, and can we save even more. We're redeveloping our vineyard to look at, you know, can we do dry farming? Can we implement regenerative farming? You know, sort of different things are looking there. Little things like putting hand dryers in, coming later this year, in the restrooms, changing the hose nozzles that we have to save a little bit of water. I mean, the ideas coming from our employees are just so numerous, and everyone's so excited about being a part of this and really making a difference. So
the wine industry definitely will suffer if we don't solve this, right? The drought or extreme weather, how would that potentially impact long-term?
You know, we always talk about over the grade, it seems to be getting hotter and hotter, right? So then that means we grow cab here in down here in the valley, where we traditionally grow a cooler climate varietal, Pinot. But actually, I think what we're seeing is it's the extremes, right? So actually, as it's been getting hotter over the grade, it's actually been getting cooler at the coast, which is where we are. So maybe we get to a point where we can't even ripen our grapes. You know, they ripen them in a nanosecond up there, and we can't ever get there. So we have to see where the weather takes us. On the drought part, like I said, we're looking at, you know, can we do dry farming? How can we better preserve, you know, conserve water as we grow our grapes? I think that's an important, certainly in Paso, where already you can't get enough water. Edna Valley hasn't hit that yet, but it's just a matter of time. So everyone has to conserve.
Are there interesting things on the horizon for Edna Valley?
Yeah, you know, any day now, it should have been months ago, there's a new AVA, American Viticultural Area appellation, that's going to be approved. It's called the San Luis Obispo Coast, and it is the region sort of to the west of the Santa Lucia Ridge there, from Santa Barbara County line to the Monterey County line. So that whole coastal region. So it's not Paso, it's the whole coastal region. And I think that will give us a lot in common with our coastal neighbors, and it will also really put San Luis Obispo Coast on the map, right? To have our own AVA. And that's what a lot of us are going to be putting on the labels, because Edna Valley's super small. And I think the coast is going to be really an exciting thing.
I love the idea of the Coast AVA to really kind of highlight all the great work you're doing.
You know, if people are interested in our wine region, the San Luis Obispo Coast Wine Collective is our local wine region Vintners Association. It's gone through a few different names over time. So that's where we are now, San Luis Obispo Coast Wine Collective. We have a website at slowcoastwine.com. The last thing that we're really looking to really continue to focus on is diversity in the wine industry. It's gotten a lot of bad rap over the last year about being, you know, not so inclusive. And we've taken a hard look at what we do and trying to make sure that we are acting in a much more inclusive manner. So that's something that we're excited to see how that pans out over the next few years.
That was the Slow Chambers' Jim D'Antona speaking with June McIver of Tolosa Winery in the Edna Valley. And finally, I dug into the Issues and Ideas archive for this episode of Playing with Food. I didn't dig too deep, just back to January, but it's worth a listen now as fresh figs are showing up in the markets and ripening on our trees.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Recently, a cooking website posted a photo of a beautiful arrangement of cut figs, declaring it fig season. So I posted it on social media and asked if anyone local grew figs. When Jackie Williams responded, I had no idea it was going to be such an amazing journey.
Well, I'm Jackie Williams, and I'm a retired garden designer. I believe in designing accessible and edible gardens, and drought tolerant, of course, for slow. Okay, well, let's go around to the fig trees and let me introduce you to them. They're in the backyard. Our back gate alarm.
This is definitely edible. Everything that I see here, you've got a lot of stuff going on, and you've got a koi pond as well.
And a greenhouse.
And a greenhouse.
So, but here I have a couple of fig trees. They're called brown turkey. And not turkey from the animal, but from the region of Turkey. They're a Mediterranean fig that was originally from Turkey.
So you moved 47 different times.
We did.
And so you're responsible for the migration of this fig from where?
Well, we first were stationed in Coronado, and then we went back to Pensacola, and we've been in Norfolk, Virginia. We went down to Cuba for a while.
So all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
You said it's a Mediterranean plant. And you've been in a lot of different climates. So is it easy to grow? I mean, this plant is huge.
It is. And the interesting thing is figs can, by and large, take a pretty hard freeze. Not like places where it snows and stays cold for a long time. But if it goes down to 20 overnight for a while, it'll be fine. They'll come back. So in the south, where we lived in those places, Virginia and places like that, it got very cold in the winter and froze for days. And the fig survives. It's a good choice for out here because we so seldom get freezes.
Right.
And I don't know that it might do in Paso because it can stand a freeze. But, you know, if they didn't have one of those killer frosts.
Obviously, during the growing season, it needs the heat.
And that's the problem. You can see a lot of these figs are still green, Father Ian. And the reason is because we didn't have our heat until this recent heat wave. And they really need the heat.
This tree is so big that there's a lot of fruit on this at every stage. There's green ones that are the diameter of about a half an inch, all the way up to ripe ones that are about an inch and a half in diameter. So how long is this tree going to be producing?
It'll go until all the trees are ripe and picked, and that's usually in September. Some of them winter over if it gets really cold before they get ripe. And the way we know that is because all the leaves will be off the tree. So when the leaves are all off the tree, that's the end of the season.
Okay, and the ones that haven't ripened won't ripe.
Right. But they'll stay on the tree, and then when in the beginning of the next year's season, they'll be really large, much larger than these.
Will they be ready earlier than the new fruit?
Yes, those were the first ones to come, and of course, they've all been picked.
So you'll kind of end up having an early crop and then the main crop at the end of the summer?
No, it depends on heat, because the next year's crop starts right exactly when the last year's does. They might be a little further out on the limb. And the way you root this is you just cut a little limb off and put it in a jar of water in the kitchen window or something. And it'll grow roots, and then you just put it in dirt. And figs like to have their feet crowded, so a fig tree will grow like in a wine barrel for many years.
Okay. There will be pictures of this one on the podcast page. This started from a cutting how many years ago?
Well, it was in a barrel for quite a while before I put it in the ground, but it started from a cutting in 2000 when we moved here.
Okay, so it's only 20 years old.
Right.
And it's really big.
You know, though, the reason it's not sky high is because we cut it down every year because, we used to go to the farm supply fruit seminars out there, and the professor that taught them said, just remember, prune low, fruit low, pick low. So we're not having to be up on ladders to pick. So we cut it down every year.
You've got plenty of fruit on this.
Yes.
What do you do besides make this jam?
My grandmother was famous for her fig preserves. Well, I like jam better than preserves, but I still use her same recipe, just smush them up at the end.
What's the difference between jam and preserves?
Preserves are the whole fruit, and they sit in a simple syrup and a sugar syrup, and then you put them on the stove in a water bath and seal them in the jars. The jam, before you put them in the water, in the jars, in the water bath, you smush them. I just smush them with a potato masher. The other thing I do is I cut the stems off. When you do preserves, you leave a piece of the stem on, and it makes the whole fruit stay together.
Sounds like it's harder to spread on toast, though.
Oh, it is, but then it's great to pull right out of the jar and pop one in your mouth.
What do you do with fresh ones?
We eat them. We've been eating them the whole time they've been ripe. Just right off the tree, or rinse them and put them in a bowl in the fridge. There's one in there in my fridge now. My kids were all here last week, and they took them back to San Francisco and L.A. and San Diego, so we share.
So that's good for the digestive system.
Yes, I think they are.
Do you ever dry any of them?
I tried that last year, Father Ian, and I must have left them in my dryer too long because they were kind of like little rocks. Now, I buy dried figs, so I'm sure that I could. Usually I just go ahead and can them so that they'll have enough to last all year.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian, picking Turkish brown figs. Jackie Williams has been a real-life Johnny Appleseed with her fig cuttings. You've got these plants all over, in 47 different parts of the country. Have you ever revisited one of those plants?
Oh, yes, often. In Coronado, we had one, and we loved it. In San Diego, we lived over by the golf course and had a great one in the courtyard there. So some of my 47 moves were within the same town. We'd get stationed somewhere and then be in one house and then move to another. But we've also gone back to my grandmother's. I got a cutting from one of her figs. After she was already passed away, I visited her old house and took a cutting from one of her trees the month before Hurricane Katrina came. So that's been some time ago, and I got it started and then shared it with one of the kids. So we have cousins in Texas who have them. Our whole family, my grandmother Ida Alice Daniels Reeves, was called Mammy, as they do. And so Mammy's figs are all over the country.
Wow, that's amazing. You are a gardener.
Yes.
So you know about these things. Is there any element of invasive species of the fig?
No. You might think so in California. If you're driving around and you see along creek beds and so forth, you'll see wild figs out in the countryside. But an invasive species indicates that it's replaced a native species by being so prolific. And I wouldn't call these that prolific. They do recede, and they'll travel down the creek and sprout up somewhere else. But they're not prolific enough to really take off like some of the grasses have and that kind of thing.
Will anything push out a fig?
Well, if you let gophers get at the roots on a baby one, you'll lose it. But no, they have a white, milky substance in their stems. I think that keeps most things from eating them, like a lot of succulents do. So even though they're not poisonous, that's one of the things that usually keeps other critters from eating them. Although once when we were in San Diego, we woke up one morning to hearing an animal in the front yard, and we went out, and there was a fox up in the tree feasting on our figs. So that was kind of fun.
Even enjoyed by the foxes.
Yeah.
So can I dive in here?
Please do.
Okay, so what am I looking for?
Well, feel one of the ones that's kind of dark. Yes, that one's a good one. Does it feel soft?
This one feels, it feels plump, not soft.
No, that's soft enough. Instead of pulling it that way, you want to push down on the stem.
So you actually, I want to break that off.
Yes.
Okay.
And then if you want to cut it to clean it, you'll just cut it across here.
Right below the stem.
Right below the stem. So, yes.
Okay.
So, yes, shall we pick a few?
Yeah.
I can help you pick if
you want.
It's
hard to do this.
Well, it's fun. And I'm happy to share some with you.
Okay. Some are really, really ripe. What happens if you eat one that's underripe? What does it taste like?
They don't have their flavor developed completely, just like any other fruit. If you wait and pick them when they're ripe, they'll have a better, more full, rounded flavor. And that's true of oranges, lemons. Like, so often I wait on my citrus until they actually fall off the bush and then take them in, because they're really much sweeter then.
What's the flavor difference between these and the Mission Figs?
I believe these are sweeter. You'll have to take some home and do a taste test. Do you have a Mission Fig tree?
I do not.
Oh, do you know someone who does?
I do not.
Well, you can find them all over town. They're black. There's some down on the creek if you want to take the bridge across the creek there.
Okay. Oh, right downtown.
Yeah.
Okay, that's easy access.
And if you pick those, you'll see they are a little more pithy. They're certainly larger.
When I went to the creekside in downtown San Luis Obispo, the giant untamed fig tree across the creek from Mission Plaza was full of figs, but they were green and hard. I didn't get to do the side-by-side comparison tasting.
Will these ripen on the counter?
Yes, they'll keep ripening, and you can put them, if you like, in the sun. Like, we have a table in the sun in our sunroom, and they ripen there. We're glad the figs come in over a couple of weeks.
Well, I think that's plenty. I think that's more than plenty, actually, to figure out what to do with. So you like making preserves and jam, or eating them plain.
I do.
I should compare them with a Mission Fig, and then maybe figure out a way to do something interesting.
You can certainly cook them. You can make galettes and tarts. You can put them in pancakes. Any way you'll use a stone fruit or any other fruit.
Do you do certified organic gardening?
I'm not certified. You have to do a lot of paperwork for that. And this is for our own consumptions. I think you have to be in production to be certified. But it certainly is organic, because we feed birds here. We have kids that come and eat. We share our vegetables with our friends, and we do not use chemicals. We have many delightful bugs, lots of little caterpillars and pests. And right now we're battling ants, and we're hoping a flicker moves in the flicker box to eat ants. Usually, if you find that you have something going on in your garden, there's a way, a plant, a companion plant, or an animal, or a bird, or a bug that you can plant or have that will balance that. So you want a balanced ecosystem. You don't want to start introducing killer items. Especially like we have gophers here. If we poisoned our gophers, they would go running out in the field, and we have hawks, and that would kill the hawks. So it's really important not to certify organic, but not to use chemicals that pollute our environment.
What you put in and take out of the ecosystem goes both ways.
Exactly.
So the hawks kill the gophers so they don't kill your plants, but if you put pesticides on your plants, which kill the gophers, it kills the hawks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or if you put poisons out for them, rat poison. People use those all the time, and mouse poisons. You can get a really good little mouse trap. You just put peanut butter in there, and they come and go in it. Oh, it's, my sister's moved it, I guess. Yes, and this is a gopher trap. You just push that down in their hole, and it catches them, and then we can release them, throw them in the field, and the hawks eat them, and it doesn't hurt them. Here's a ripe one. And you can see one that was lunch for a blue jay probably there.
Yeah. How do you get in the middle?
Oh, I just move the branches apart and get in there. You want to have some long sleeves on. Some people are allergic to fig leaves. It'll make you itch. So you're going to want to wear long sleeves before you go climbing in there.
I didn't climb in there. I got enough to experiment with and went on my merry way. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian, and Jackie Williams has just enlightened me on the wonders of growing figs. One sunny morning, I was sitting on the back patio of a local coffee shop. I had been there many times before. I was probably working on a sermon, and you know how you do that gazing into the middle distance when you're reflecting? Well, the middle distance happened to land my eyes upon a two-story, two-wall, sprawling vine covered with figs. I took a photo, which actually only showed the large green wall, posted it on social media, tagged my sister that she should make fig jam when they are ripe. Lots of fig jam. Then Christine Hill, who is much more versed in horticulture than I, put in her comments, which probably saved my life, and she expanded on them more recently.
I'm thinking about the old saying, if these walls could talk, and I'm going to add the word vines, Vines and walls could talk, because never a truer thought about Linnea's courtyard and the creeping fig vine that grows in the back patio. I can't imagine how many people have sat back there and looked up above and seen this amazing vine that travels the complete expanse of the patio. And I would imagine that most people pretty much ask the same question. Do you think that I could eat this? Well, I have no doubt that the staff has spent a lot of time and energy cleaning up the spit-out fruit that people have discarded out of their mouths because of this bitter taste and this sticky white milk that is considered poisonous when it gets on the skin and causes severe rashes. The mouth will even swell up. So it is considered poisonous, and one's question is answered clearly and immediately. Nature is so interesting, and it's complexly woven. So I ask, why would the fig tree produce a fig that is safe and revered for its offerings in so many different kinds of recipes, and the creeping fig fruit be poisonous when they look so similar and they are from the same family? I just know and I trust Mother Nature. There is a good reason.
I didn't do any experimenting, no playing with food with the figs. The playing with food bit I outsourced.
So, Dusty, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
I didn't do anything with figs. I did my usual. I had figs with blue cheese on toast. I had figs with blue cheese and bacon. You know, that's how I eat my figs. So I devolved my responsibility of playing with food to you to see what you could do with figs. So what did you end up doing with figs?
Naturally, of course, they went into a cocktail. It was actually really fun and fortuitous, because I do enjoy figs. And don't get me wrong, your way of doing figs is absolutely pleasing to me. If they show up on a cheese plate, I'm ecstatic, but also content to drink them in this instance. An idea for a cocktail came to me fairly quickly because I was trying to pull elements out of a cake that I recently had just had that had figs incorporated into it. So it kind of led me into these flavor profiles that I already knew were going to work really well together, because I enjoyed them in the cake that I had.
That's cool.
So I just kind of took the figs. I macerated a handful of them, crushed down with some demerara sugar, which definitely has a little bit more of those malty, molassesy tastes to it. And then paired that with some black peppers. Black pepper really brings out the sweetness and the floral qualities of the figs. And then some amaretto to mimic some almond flavoring that had been in the cake, and had a tamarind glaze, kind of added that tartness.
So a tartness that matches the flavor profile of figs, whereas we normally think of cocktail tartness with grapefruit juice or some sort of citrus lemon-lime, which doesn't go with figs.
Yeah. It would have masked the flavor of the figs too much. Shake all the ingredients together, strain it into a beautiful coupe glass, and then garnish with a cut slice of fig, really showing off that flesh that is so iconic when we think of when we cut a fig in half and it's got that kind of green rim with that beautiful jewel tone, almost amethyst-like quality in the middle.
Most importantly, how did it taste?
Oh, it tasted absolutely delicious. It was like the liquid version of that cake that I had. So I was quite pleased to add this one to my repertoire.
Exactly. And is this a drink that you will make again? Is it going to go into your cocktail book?
Absolutely. Also because it photographs really well with those iconic fig look, but it also tasted really delicious and had a really fun nuance and balance to it. It didn't taste like a cocktail that I'd previously had, but definitely I may have made a batch or two for myself once I had the syrup ready to go already. Waste not, want not.
Unfortunately, I didn't get to taste it. I think I would have enjoyed it. It actually sounds quite healthy and wholesome. If you pass by a fig tree, not a fig vine, and there are ripe fruit weighing it down, do the tree a favor and pluck yourself a basket of figs. All manner of delicious foods and drinks will fill your dinner table. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.